Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Arya Irani, and I will be the host for today's Hinckley Forum. The Hinckley Institute was established in 1965 through the generous bequests of the Nobel Foundation and Robert H. Hinckley. The Institute is dedicated to teaching students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. The Hinckley Institute offers paid internships to students of all majors here locally in Washington, D.C., and in 35 countries around the globe. The Hinckley Institute also offers classes, the nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences to Washington, D.C., and over $70,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door or to visit our website at www.hinckley.utah.edu to find more information. The title of today's forum is Geopolitics and International Security. Is there a successful military strategy for an unwinnable war? Today's guest is Amos Giora. Amos Giora is a professor of law and co-director of the Center for Global Justice and the S.Q. Queeney College of Law at the University of Utah. Giora, who teaches criminal procedure, international law, global perspectives on the counterterrorism and religion and terrorism, incorporates innovative scenario-based instruction to address national and international security issues and dilemmas. He is a member of the American Bar Association's Law and National Security Advisory Committee, a research associate at the University of Oxford, Oxford's Institute for Ethics, Law and Armed Conflict, a research fellow at the International Institute on Counterterrorism, the Interdisciplinary Center, Hirsala, Israel, thank you, a corresponding member, the Netherlands School of Human Rights Research, University of Utrecht School of Law, and was awarded a Senior Specialist Fulbright Fellowship for the Netherlands in 2008. Professor Giora has published extensively both in the U.S. and Europe on issues related to national security, limits of interrogation, religion and terrorism, the limits of power and multiculturalism, and human rights. He's the author of Global Perspectives on Counterterrorism, first and second editions, Fundamentals of Counterterrorism, Constitutional Limits on Cohesive Integration, Homeland Security, What Is It and Where Is It Going, and Freedom from Religion, Rights and National Security, first and second editions. Professor Giora has received grants from both the Stewart Family Foundation and the Earhart Foundation. He served for 19 years in the Israel Defense Forces as Lieutenant Colonel, retired, and held a number of senior command positions, including commander of the IDF School of Military Law and legal advisor for the Gaza Strip. Professor Giora was awarded the S.Q. Queeney College of Law Faculty Scholarship Award in 2011. Please join me in welcoming our speaker. No problem. Here's some water for you, too.
Can you, wait, I don't need this.
You don't need the computer?
No. I can see it by myself.
Oh, okay. Do you want me to just, don't close it all the way, just so it can show.
Can you hear me? So, good afternoon. Just as a quick follow-up to that gracious introduction, geopolitics is outside, speaking frankly, is outside of my usual comfort zone. Because generally I write about counterterrorism, about religion, and I decided to write this book for the following reason, and then I'll get into the PowerPoint. Before I get into the PowerPoint, I have to apologize. I hate PowerPoints. I think this is only, right, Jason, this is only the second time I've ever used a PowerPoint, and I'm not very good at it, so bear with me. I got into this book for the following reason. From 1994 to 1999, I was deeply and intimately involved in the implementation of the Oslo peace process in the Middle East, particularly with respect to Israel and Palestinians. And I wrote an article about my involvement in the peace process. Again, I didn't want to write the article, but a colleague of mine suggested I write the article. And once I saw that the article was being used worldwide in terms of teaching how to negotiate, I said, okay, I'm done with that. And then the same colleague, Jim Holbrook, said, well, the article was successful. Why don't you write a book about this? And I said, no, I won't write a book about this. And here I am writing a book about this. The question is, at least how I define geopolitics, is the following question. Is there a strategy for an unwinnable conflict? And I think more than anything else, in today's extraordinarily complex world, that, I think, is the fundamental question. Is there a strategy, whatever the word strategy means, winnable or unwinnable, whatever that means, and conflict, whatever that means? But that's going to be, that is the theme of the book, and I hope to be able to address that in the next few minutes. And the only way this will work is as we speak, or as I speak, as you answer, ask questions, I'm smack in the middle of writing the book. So, Kirk, I thank you for the perfect timing here. I deeply request a no-holds-barred conversation. I need your feedback. I don't need to be told this is really interesting. I need to be told why this is not good, okay? All right. The world today, I suggest the world today is comprised of three different entities, if you will. One is the nation state, as we know the state to be. The other is this thing called globalization, the world trying to function as some kind of a unified economic entity. And the third one is perhaps the most interesting, this idea of regional conflicts. So when I was your age back in the 17th century, the world was largely divided between East and West, right? The United States and this former country called the Union of Soviet Socialist Republic, right? The Soviet Union. And they divided the world in half. Boom, one side went here, the other side went there. It was pretty much of a binary world. There were some non-aligned countries, but the world used to be in many ways much easier and simpler than it is today. This idea of regional conflicts between nation states and non-state actors is, I think, the essence of conflict today, and we're going to keep, you have to keep in mind all three pieces as we move forward. All right. Unfortunately, because I'm a law professor, first of all, unfortunately, I'm a law professor, and unfortunately, because I'm a law professor, where we make our living is defining terms. We love to define terms. And so with the great help of Jason here, Jason's created this terrific PowerPoint with these these rolling balls. Okay. If I understand how this works, the definitions come up later, right? Okay. All right, hang on. Boom, boom, boom. I suggest that the only way to really understand this extraordinarily complex thing called geopolitics is by breaking it down into each separate ball. The essence of it is the following. There are two heads to this conversation. One is the nation state uses force, but my thesis is that the use of force is ultimately clearly limited with a huge question as to its effectiveness. And precisely because I'm not convinced that the use of state force is effective, what I suggest at the end of the day, again in the context of geopolitics, is that the state has no alternative but to engage in some kind of cooperation and negotiation. So it's this two-headed head, one that says use of force. On the other hand, precisely because the use of force is limited, if not ineffective, there's a need to engage in negotiations. All right, definitions. So geopolitics. If you read about geopolitics, go online, Wikipedia, and Google Schmoogle, you will see a bazillion different definitions of geopolitics. We could write a book about the definition of geopolitics, but because you're stuck with me for the next few minutes, I define it as this relationship between geography and the nation state. I cannot emphasize the importance of understanding geography. Now, I don't know if geography, is geography even taught? Yes? All right. So when I was in eighth grade, way back when, you learned geography. And it turns out, you know, actually geography is really important because there's no understanding of resources, no understanding of conflict without understanding geography. I mean, it's boring as hell, mountains here and rivers there, right? We all have to memorize that, right? Right? In the back row, you old guys, right? Okay. But it turns out it's important. You cannot understand the world and you cannot understand tensions and pressures without understanding geography. And the flip side of geography, obviously, is how does the nation state fit into that? Complicated in that, and Jason, we need to add here, is the non-state actor. Okay. All right, security. So we would all like to be secure, right, obviously. The question is, in the context of international security, to what extent is there mutual cooperation? I take you back to, let's look at the Iraq War, right? So there that President Bush, and Kirk were like this, President Bush was able to bring in all the nations of the world together and all worked famously and fabulously. And here we are in Afghanistan with about three or four allies still with us. And so this idea of international security, I would suggest, sounds good, but may well be an intellectual misnomer. All right, diplomacy. Nation states have no choice but to engage in conversations with other countries. And it's all predicated, for lack of a better term, mutual self-interest. The only reason country A will discuss something with country B is because there's a mutual self-interest. The question is, can you find a mutual self-interest? Self-defense. Well, you know, we're all in favor of self-defense. The United Nations Charter, Article 51, defines self-defense. The question, however, in the context of limited use of force is what is actually lawful self-defense, and when should it be limited? Key term here, again, limited. Intervention. So two examples, one good one and one, I don't know what we're going to do with it. Libya, right? So the United States under the guise of NATO, or NATO under the guise of the United States, went into Libya, intervened, Gaddafi's dead, and is it good for the Libyans? Who knows? But the United States actively intervened there. On the other hand, is clear here, is Syria. So as we're having this conversation, I don't know the numbers, 100,000 people have been killed? Is that right? 70,000, 100,000, give, you know, one here, one there, have been killed by the Assad regime in Syria. It's unclear who used the chemical weapon. Today's Tuesday. It's unclear who used the chemical weapons on Sunday. Was it the Assad regime or was it the other side? But here's what's clear. Former Secretary of State Clinton did her finger wagging at the Assad regime, and she said, "Tisk tisk, this is really naughty of you." And that's all that the world has done, is said, you know, this really shouldn't happen. And then the question becomes, in the context of geopolitics and intervention, is when should the world intervene? Syria is a classic example for non-intervention, and I think the world here bears a collective, scarlet letter of shame for not intervening as thousands upon thousands upon thousands of people are being killed. Okay. Leadership. Old people like me will tell you that as I look around the world today in context of understanding geopolitics, the world today is bereft of leaders. And that's particularly problematic because if a world is bereft of leaders, it means that people are making tactical decisions only, absolutely devoid of strategic thinking. And the question is, where are leaders going to come from? So it's a terrific opportunity to speak to young people here, put in my pitch for this. If you have the opportunity to go into public service, go into public service. International cooperation in many ways is the flip of international security. So the world likes to, you know, like Iraq, Afghanistan, but the question is what happens afterwards? Can the world come together and think together how to resolve tension and conflict? And again, predicated on mutual self-interest, does international cooperation always happen? The answer probably not, but it's important to geopolitics. Negotiation. All right. So from 1994 to 1999, when I was involved in negotiating implementation of the peace process with the Palestinians while serving the Israel Defense Forces, it became clear to me, or the following became clear to me, and it's all totally tied into this. One, each side knows very little about the other. And it's really difficult to negotiate if you're starting from a position of not really understanding the other side and not understanding what the other side wants. That's point one. Point two, it's really hard to negotiate if you don't know what you want. Point three, it's really hard to negotiate when it's unclear what called the third party. And I'll give you an example in a second. What's the role of the third party? And four, what makes it difficult is, are you going to speak the truth to your own public? So by a couple of examples. There is something called the safe passage, which links the Gaza Strip to the West Bank. And I got a phone call one evening from a one-star general who asked me, what are my plans tomorrow? And anytime a one-star general calls and asks you, what are your plans tomorrow? The obvious answer is, whatever you would like me to do, that's what I'll do. And he said, well, you're going to negotiate this agreement, which was the heart and soul of the Oslo peace process. And I said, do I get any, you know, instructions? Is anybody going to tell me what to do? And I was told the scariest words, Kirk, you as a lawyer will appreciate this, when the client tells you, whatever you think is right, we trust you. And as a lawyer, though, that is a really bad piece of message sending because by the client. Why? Because if you screw it up, it's on you, and if it works out, he looks good. Okay. So off I went and negotiated safe passage, and I asked the one star, I said, how long will this take? I mean, how long out of my life am I not going to dedicate to, you know, negotiating this damn thing? And I was told 1 week. 1 week. I said, well, you know, 1 week I can work it into my schedule. 5 years later, right? So it took us 5 years to negotiate it. But in terms of understanding in terms of international cooperation, the role of the third party, I was flown along with a couple of other Palestinians and Israelis to Washington, D.C., to what the Washington Post euphemistically referred to as a secret government installation in Northern Virginia. And we were brought into a room, oh, about three times the size of this room. And in that zip code were two Israelis, myself and another fella. In that zip code were two Palestinians. And in that zip code, five zip codes down, were three Americans, CIA, we assume CIA, National Security Council, and the White House. They all had the same first name. Kirk, how does that work? All these guys always have the same first names? I don't know how that works. And none of them had a last name, which I found to be peculiar. So first of all, if you ever go into negotiations, you never want to be in a room where you have to yell. It's really hard to create intimacy if you're yelling, right? And so I don't know who were the Americans who were responsible for this, but it was a total screw-up. And so we were literally yelling at each other. But we weren't yelling at each other. We were talking to the Americans, who were talking to the Palestinians, who would be talking to the Americans. We were doing this. All right. So we spent a week negotiating safe passage, and I wrote the agreement. We finished on a Thursday evening, and I wrote it, and everybody was really happy because at the end we had to present it to Dennis Ross, who was Clinton's ambassador to the Middle East. The then Israeli foreign minister and the then Abu Mazen, who today is the president of the Palestinian Authority, and they all congratulated us and congratulated me for writing the agreement. It was all hunky-dory. And we agreed that we would meet in a signing ceremony on Monday, and it was all really cool. And we came to the signing ceremony where all the foreign media were there, right? And it was like going to be a big moment, and I was given the honor of, you know, the photo opportunity to give it to the Palestinian counterpart because we had negotiated together and I'd written the agreement. It was all very cool, and my parents were all excited. Okay, fine. The only problem was the following. When I gave him the agreement that he and I had written, he and I had spent 5 days killing each other writing this damn thing, he looked at it and he said the following. This is all, you can Google schmoogle this, right? He says, Amos, I always knew you were a person of great talents, but you always, anytime in life anybody gives you a compliment, you know there's a but coming, right? And he said, but I had no idea you were a writer of fiction. And I remember looking at the Israeli who was a senior to me and saying, well, what do we do now? Now you got to understand, the cameras are rolling. This is live. And the Israeli who was senior to me said, we're out of here. We're out of here. And we walked out. Now, what had happened? While we were, you know, pleased with ourselves, he had had to present the agreement to the then president of the Palestinian Authority, Yasser Arafat. And when Arafat read what this guy had agreed to, Arafat, figuratively speaking, not literally, but figuratively, chopped off his head. Maybe also literally, but figuratively, clearly. Because he had agreed to concessions that Arafat found unacceptable. Now, that's fine. That's the way this stuff works. But where's the failure? We did not know that. And so in the context of everything we're talking about, I cannot sufficiently emphasize the importance of intelligence information, intelligence gathering. And so I, speaking very frankly, whoever was doing our intelligence gathering failed here totally because we had to start all over again. So when you think about negotiations, always ask yourself, what do you want? What does the other side want? And how well do you really understand the two? And how much do you understand your own public? Sovereignty. So I don't know, how many of you are thinking about going to law school? How many of you fantasize about law school? Okay. So this idea of sovereignty, every nation state, you know, has its own borders and has its own military and has its own national anthem and its own airline. That's fine. But the reality of the conflict today between state and non-state actors is sovereignty is being minimized. Because the bad guys, non-state actors, are sitting in the land of sovereign nations, and other sovereign nations are violating the sovereignty, and I'll give you an example. So if you, anytime you, you know, however you get your news, wherever you get your news from, you'll see it on a daily basis, we're conducting drone strikes in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Yemen, Nigeria, Somalia, seven, eight countries by now. Every time we do that, we're violating their sovereignty. Now, we're not trying to kill Pakistanis, Afghans, Yemenis, Somalis, Nigerians, we're not trying to kill them. We're trying to kill the bad guys who are physically there. Are we violating the sovereignty of those countries? Yes. Are we in violation of international law? Every day. Every single day the United States is violating international law. Is that important in terms of understanding geopolitics? You bet. Is anybody really saying anything about this? The answer is no, because we have the drones and we have this and we have that, but we are clearly violating international law. From a geopolitical perspective, if you think about it long term, are we causing ourselves a potential headache down the road? The answer is yes. Containment. So back to the Soviet Union and the Cold War, which we heroically won, we try to contain the Soviet Union without actually engaging them. Right? The whole idea of George Kennan's containment theory was to somehow lock them, block them, without actually having to kill anybody. Did it at the end of the day win? I think the answer clearly is yes. And for those of you who are interested in political science and history, there is a fabulous, fabulous book. Just came out, a biography of George Kennan, by John Lewis Gaddis, who is a professor at Yale. It took him 25 years to write the biography of Kenan, because Kenan granted him access to all of his private papers. An extraordinary biography, well worth reading. Question is, does containment work in the context of terrorism? I got a very interesting email yesterday from a colonel in the United States military, who's willing, I'm showing him my stuff as I'm writing this, and he tells me the answer is no, because at some point you have to engage. Containment was predicated on not engaging. The question is that sufficient in the context of terrorism? You know, who knows? And the flip side of containment, obviously, the use of force. When do you use force? So I speak to you as somebody who has authorized, while serving in the Israel Defense Forces, I authorized the use of force. I actually was involved also in what we refer to as targeted killing, which in the United States is the drone policy. So yes, use of force, yes, but when, to what extent, and to what ends? One of the great questions, in many ways unanswered at the moment. And last but not least, this idea of failed states. So go back to what I told you about sovereignty. We in the United States say the following. We are not violating Pakistani sovereignty because Pakistan can't keep the bad guys out, right? We whacked bin Laden in Pakistan because Pakistan is not a failed state. We would never say that about an American ally, but quasi-failed state, incapable of keeping the bad guys out. And because we define the United States national security so broadly, it's convenient for us to say Pakistan, Afghanistan, Yemen, Somalia, are not quite failed states, but partial failed states. And if they're partial failed states, you can legitimately, so goes the theory, violate their sovereignty, and therefore you can engage in the use of force with an expanded view of self-defense. What does all that mean? Well, in answering the question, those complicated questions, I'm looking at three different case studies. One is Iraq-Afghanistan, four, Israel-Palestine, and Syria and Pakistan. So when President Bush went into Iraq, I was, frankly speaking, skeptical as to why. And here we are 10 years later. We at the law school last Thursday did an event 10 years looking back. I have no idea why we went to Iraq. Zero idea. There were no WMDs. Saddam Hussein was never in bed with Osama bin Laden. And we were not going to bring democracy to Iraq. I mean, no. So we went to Iraq. And Jason here, who is my research assistant, is a veteran who served in the military. I have no idea why we went to Iraq. The long-term damage to the United States, I would suggest, is extraordinary. And then we went to Afghanistan, because if it wasn't Iraq, you have to go to Afghanistan also, because it's on the way. And I don't know what we're doing in Afghanistan. I know we're going to declare victory, and we're going to leave next year. We're going to leave. The numbers change every 2 minutes. Sometimes it's 30,000. Sometimes it's 12,000. And let me tell you, as somebody who served in the military, to leave 30,000 or 12,000 soldiers in Afghanistan is a crime. Because all you're doing is, their only mission is to stay safe. And that's not a mission. We're putting people in harm's way for the purpose of staying safe. You know, dude, come home. So we declare victory, but we stay. Now, if you follow the news carefully, you'll see that in Iraq, every 5 minutes there's a suicide bombing. 50 people killed, 100 people killed, and you heard it here first. The moment we leave Afghanistan, first of all, there's no country called Afghanistan, right? It's a conglomeration of tribes. All hell will break loose. All hell is going to break loose. And then the question in the context of geopolitics, why did we go in? And why did we not learn from the extraordinarily successful, I say cynically, Soviet experience in 1979 in Afghanistan, which turned out to be pretty much the end of the Soviet Union? And why did we go into Afghanistan? You got me. All right, Israeli-Palestinian peace process raises really important questions. My twin-headed monster, limits of power and negotiation. In many ways, that's what that reflects. Syria, go back to the key question about international humanitarian intervention, yes, no, maybe. And third, Pakistan. Why is Pakistan important? Pakistan is unbelievably important for the following reasons. First of all, the Pakistanis receive, I don't know how many hundreds of millions or billions of aid from the United States. For reasons known but to God, wherever he, she, it is, Pakistan has the bomb. And that's stunning. I mean, it's absolutely stunning that Pakistan has the bomb. And there's no doubt whatsoever that there's the Pakistani government, but Pakistan also has a shadow government called the ISI, the Pakistani Intelligence Community, which really runs Pakistan. They're the ones that, through them, bin Laden was there. So you have a government of Pakistan, and now you have a shadow government. And note that yesterday or Sunday, the former president of Pakistan came back to try to save Pakistan. Why is this important? You think about a country which is a quasi-failed state with nuclear warheads. You think about the geopolitics and you think about international security, Pakistan raises all kinds of huge questions. All right, issues. Number one, mission. I don't know, have any of you ever served in the military? Do you have friends who served in the military? You'll appreciate this. A number of years ago, I was invited to West Point to come speak to the Corps of Cadets, which in real life is an extraordinary honor. And so I had the cadets in front of me, and I asked them, I said, what's the mission in Iraq? Why are we going to Iraq? And I got the deer in the headlights look that we as academics, when we ask questions that you guys haven't done your reading for, you know that, oh, shit, haven't done the reading? And when I asked them what the mission was, it was clear to me that they had no idea what the mission was. And that is deeply, deeply troubling because we continue to put young people in harm's way for reasons known but to whomever. Next, goals. We refuse to articulate why we're doing what we're doing. In the context of geopolitics, it means that you do not have a strategy in place. You just have tactical measures. Geopolitics predicated on tactics rather than strategy means there is no geopolitics. It means there is no strategy. It means you're just lurching from event to event. And the third thing is this thing called resource allocation. So your parents may have told you there happens to be an economic crisis in the world today. This is new news, freshly off the New York Times. And we're spending bazillions of dollars and unbelievable resources. And the question is, to what ends? And I find that here in the United States, to be frank, we are unwilling or incapable, pick your poison, to address this question honestly. What are the limits of the resources we have? And this became very clear to me a couple of years ago. I was invited to testify in front of the House of Representatives Homeland Security Committee, which is a great honor. And, you know, once you get beyond, it's a privilege to be here, blah, blah. And you tell them, the first thing you have to do is define terms, which I've just done. And two, we have to have a conversation about the limited resources and prioritization of resources. And if you want to see members of Congress faint, that's exactly when they faint, because it means that they actually have to, A, define terms, and B, state publicly that we have limited resources. And that makes people very uncomfortable, but we have no choice but to have this discussion. All right. Moving forward, this long discussion about strategy. I suggest here in the United States, we're maybe, I'm not sure, maybe good at tactical considerations. We are really bad at strategic considerations. Post 9/11, and I don't mean to be disrespectful to anybody's politics, but if you were to have, you know, President Obama or somebody from his staff, or if Governor Romney would have won, have Romney from his staff here, no offense, Kirk, I don't think you would have had a really serious conversation about strategy. You'd have been told a whole litany of tactics devoid of strategy. Next, and related to that, obviously, is what are your available options? What can you really do? And to what ends and to what means? Next, what are the threats? I mean, what are really the threats? Not the fake threats, but the real threats. So in real life, I spent 20 years of my life in operational counterterrorism, and I can't tell you how many times I've been told, this is a real threat, and this is a real threat, and this is a real... At the end of the day, that's the amount of real threats. And last but not least, what are the ramifications of whatever decision you make? I mean, there's an end game. And what are the ramifications? All right. Boom. Boom, 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 boom. All right. So, shit. Whoop, hang on. I told you I'm not very good at these things. I hate PowerPoints. Whoop, what did I do? Sorry about that.
No, you're just fine.
Is this like when it blows up?
Exactly.
Sorry about that.
You're just right.
Boom. Keep going down. One more. That's great. Now, how do you raise the damn thing up?
There you go.
Well, you're much better than I am. All right. So here's where the rubber hits the road. As I'm writing the book, Confession, I don't know what to do with this. With this last slide. All the slides up to now, I know what to do with them. With this slide, I don't know what to do. So one of the reasons we put this up is to get responses from whether or not this makes sense to include in the book, and I'm totally open to conversation. This is obviously not the first time I've given this talk, and it's obviously not the first group I've shared this PowerPoint with. I don't know if this makes sense, full disclosure. What I have been told by people who are in the cyberspace industry, who looked at it, I got this long email yesterday from some guy in England who says that the way to understand geopolitics moving forward is to emphasize the significance of cyberspace, cybersecurity, and how, in essence, that's going to do away with sovereignty and is going to make the world about this big. And he suggests that these issues are nice but are not the essence, and that this slide needs to be replaced with one big word, cyberspace, cybersecurity. Yeah, that's it, right? Is that the last one? Okay. So unless I put you all to sleep, that's where I'm at. From my perspective, the most beneficial and helpful thing that we could have now is a frank conversation, because as literally, I'm not exaggerating when I tell you, I'm literally in the middle of writing the book, which has to be done by May 15th, June 1st, okay? And I'm, you know, in the last chapter, but I'm writing the last chapter, but the way I write books is you leave the last chapter for last, duh, and then you work your way back, and so I'm working through the preface, including a lot of this stuff. All comments, criticisms, fire away.
We will now open the forum up to questions and comments from the audience. Please state your name clearly into the microphone and also give a brief background of your major.
Jason, you have a pen. Not to worry. Can you write the questions?
Hi, Professor.
Hi.
My name is Chris Rondom, and I'm a philosophy econ major here. It's kind of going exactly on what you said about this slide, but I wrote it down way earlier in your presentation. You're kind of having problems with leadership, and I believe that the interjection and the information flow of the internet throughout the world is kind of disintegrating any kind of leadership possibilities, because you need translucency, not transparency.
Did you read the email I got yesterday?
I don't know, maybe. Maybe it was me who wrote it. But I think that kind of trumps everything that you have on this last slide, because if you don't have the information flow, then, I don't know, everything kind of disintegrates. I'm moving into that world.
First of all, I think you may well be right. The fellow who wrote me yesterday, much like you, says that moving forward, it's all about what you call information flow. And what information flow at an extraordinary amount of information, right, that's out there, what it really does, it's going to lead to, I think your word was disintegration, it's going to lead to the disintegration of the nation state, and it's going to render, I'm exaggerating, but it's going to render, or to minimize the impact import of national leaders. That there's going to be a real struggle between the cyber world, the information world, and national leaders, and to what extent can they control the information? It's really interesting to look at specific regimes. North Korea comes to mind, right? There is no internet in North Korea, because they know that if the North Korean public ever sees the internet, they'll say, oh my, you know, this is a screwed up place. That's why Syria, Libya, all those regimes, the first thing they do is they shut down the internet. Exactly for what you're saying, there clearly is a pitched battle between, I like your term, information flow and national leadership. Because we're in March Madness, we're in the late in the second half, right? We're like this, but it may well be that the information flow is going to win out over national leaders, and that will dramatically impact geopolitics in the context of the information age, and I think that's a great point. That is a great point.
Hi, my name's Lisa. I'm studying political science. So you said that you don't know what the reasons were that we went to Iraq. Can you, like, explain reasons why we shouldn't have gone, or why the proposed reasons that we went were wrong?
Sure.
Or
so I take you back to that Tuesday morning of September the 11th, when Cheney, and it's been pretty clear in his biography and Bush's biography here, that it's Cheney, while Bush is flying around and around and around and around and around, he's racking up those speaker flying points that morning, that Cheney's the one who grabs the bull where you grab the bull, and is the one who quickly puts a plan in place to go into Iraq. Cheney convinced whoever Cheney convinced that Saddam Hussein and bin Laden were locked together. That is a lie. That is an absolute and total lie. Saddam Hussein and bin Laden despised each other. The second point that was argued was the weapons of mass destruction, okay, that Iraq had WMDs. So I'm going to share with you a story. I'm going to have to fudge a little bit. Sorry. In the fall of 2004, I had dinner in Cleveland, Ohio, with a fella who... I'm going to have to really fudge here, okay? So I apologize for that. Who had intimate knowledge of what was going on in Iraq, because he had been to Iraq on innumerable occasions for one purpose only, and that was to find WMDs. He comes to the White House and meets with the then National Security Advisor, Rice, and says to her, there are no WMDs in Iraq. None. He says, I think it'd be in the president's interest to know this. She denied him access to the president of the United States because they were locked in on this model that Iraq had WMDs as a justification for American involvement. That, too, was a lie. Three, this idea of bringing democracy to the Middle East. So I don't know the polite term. It is so patronizing, so condescending, and I really apologize for this term, horribly politically impolite, incorrect. It is so much the white man's burden. I mean, like, seriously, I mean, who the hell are we to bring anything to anybody? And, you know, it's really interesting. So this PowerPoint has made its way to Europe and all kinds of places. One of the interesting responses I've gotten is a continued insistence historically in the United States to make the world better. I mean, what does that mean? I mean, I don't know what that means. I have no idea what that means. I mean, I too was, you know, I was raised in Ann Arbor, so I can give you this whole spiel also. But I don't know what that means. So all three purported reasons for going into Iraq were wrong. To complicate the story, our actions in Iraq, violated American law and violated American principles. We tortured individuals. We illegally detained people. We continue to illegally detain people. We violated the law on a daily basis for reasons known but to whomever. Not only that, last but not least, I remind you that in the immediate aftermath of our arrival, the first thing that the Bush's guy on the ground, what was his name, Brennan? Always had these high boots on. The first thing he did is he fired people who served in the military, took their weapons, emasculated them. He literally emasculated them, created this huge unemployed category, and then said, we're going to deal with it. But what does it mean? Who are we to deal with it? So when I look at that, I have no idea why we went in, other than it served some kind of paradigm for Cheney, Bush. And the costs to America, I would suggest, are enormous. But there are two costs. One is the loss of life of American soldiers. I'm going to tell you something on that for a second. I'll come back to it. And two, we lost American soldiers. I mean, ask Jason here about his friends. Two, we lost a lot of resources. And three, we lost a lot of credibility. I mean, you go in somewhere. It's like Vietnam, right? You go in, and to what end? On a personal note, way too personal but relevant to your question. So while I served in the IDF, in the Israel Defense Forces, the scariest thing you can do as a commander, trust me, okay, is to put somebody else's child in harm's way. Trust me on that one, okay? I am not convinced, and I don't say this with a smile nor happily, that the Bush-Cheney duo really understood what it means to put people in harm's way. And I remind you that the then Vice President of the United States, Cheney, when asked, he was a draft dodger, right, from Vietnam, call it what it is. When he was asked, why didn't you go to Vietnam, I can only but quote the former Vice President of the United States, and he said the following, I was too busy, I had better things to do. That is such an extraordinary damning indictment of him. And then you put other people's children in harm's way? I don't get it. Sir, you had a question in the back.
Yeah, my name is Ola Omotoa, and I'm a health, society, and policy major.
A health?
Health, society, and policy major.
Health, society, and?
Yeah, it's one major, so it's not cool. That impressive.
Health, society, and policy?
Huh? Excuse me?
Health, society, and policy?
Yeah, health, society, and policy.
I'm running in a marathon. Does that count for health?
Earlier you were talking about drones and you started speculating, and I would just like some more information. Like, since it's going to be my generation's burden to fixing whatever mess that we're going to be into with the drones.
And we're leaving you a big mess.
What do you speculate is going to be, how do you see the national sovereignty lines going away? Do you see any issues coming about that, or any unseen issues that we're going to be dealing with?
Wow. So I begin with the following. Drones are the warfare of the future. The boots on the ground is a dying thing. What's missing in the drones discussion, this is a conversation I had with Kirk before I began the talk, is here in the United States, the drone policy is devoid of criteria and guidelines. as a result of which we're violating sovereignty regularly. And we're doing so in the following way. One, we're not defining narrowly who's a legitimate target. We're not defining imminence, and we're not defining threat. And if you don't define those three terms, it means anybody's a legitimate target. So the mess we're leaving you is the following. One, the long-term, call it soft damage to the United States in terms of the perception of the U.S. overseas. I don't know how many of you travel overseas. I mean, like, the perception of the U.S. is in large part because of that. Two, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. And so let me give you a real-life example. So we're doing drones. The last time I looked, it's either in 7 or 8 countries, right? So let me give you an example. I got interviewed, interestingly, by largest magazine in Beijing on this very question, which was interesting. She randomly, and I'm not an expert on China, but I'm told there are no random questions when you're interviewed by the Chinese media. I mean that very seriously, very seriously. There are no random questions. In the context of what's good for the goose is good for the gander, she asked me the following. What would happen if there were now a Chinese individual identified by the Chinese government as a terrorist in Salt Lake City? Could the Chinese drone him? Well, we will all say, wait, wait, wait. This is the United States of America. We are a sovereign power. And I'll say, wait a minute, we're doing the same damn thing in Pakistan, Afghanistan, boom, 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 boom. So to your question, have we thought through the counter repercussions of drones? I think not. And last but not least, this maybe goes to your question also. Your name is Chris, right?
Yes, sir.
Right. Goes to Chris's question also. What are the limits now of sovereignty, and what are the limits of the power of the nation state to protect itself if drones can go anywhere? And I don't think we have a clue. And that, I think, is particularly troubling because there's a clear decision, at least by the Obama administration, to minimize the loss of life of American soldiers. No boots on the ground, right? But there's not a decrease in American military engagement, right? A doesn't mean B. And so what are the long-term ramifications, consequences of that? You know, your guess is as good as mine, but I would be extremely wary of that. It would, I believe the expression in English, is come back and bites you somewhere, yes? That this will come back and bite us big time. Have we thought that through to your question? The answer is no. Is that the mess we're leaving you? You bet.
Hello, my name is Ali Sudarsana. I'm a political science major here. Along with the idea of I'm from Indonesia. Along with the idea of bringing democracy to Middle East, I have two simple questions here. My first question is...
Wait, one at a time. I'm not that smart.
Why would you think that democracy is not suitable for the Middle East countries? And my second question
one at a time, seriously. Who are we to impose democracy on somebody else? Who are we to tell somebody else how to run their country? I mean, like, who the hell are we? Okay. I mean, I just don't get it. I mean, I mean, obviously, I've thought about this long and hard, right? I think there's extraordinary arrogance in saying to the Iraqis, we're not going to create a democratic Iraq, or we're going to go to Libya, create a democratic Libya. I mean, I'm not an expert on multiculturalism and on culturalism, but there's an incredibly, Kirk, this would be a great person for you to bring here. She's an outrageously smart professor, interdisciplinary at Stanford. I'll give you her name. She's 35 years old. She's been named one of the 25 leading visionaries in the world. So we email a little bit. She tells me about a program, and I didn't know that this existed, that American soldiers were taught certain phrases in Arabic before they went off to Iraq, which is fine. But they were never told, if somebody responds X, how do you respond Y? So we were locked in that if we said X, they would say yes. But we never took into consideration that maybe they would say something else. And so it's a small but significant story in terms of how little we understand other cultures. In the context of bringing democracy to the Middle East, I don't think we have a clue about other cultures. Okay. And your second question?
Oh. My second question was, do you think that Sharia law would done better than democracy in Middle East?
The two answers, right? One is, I have deep reservations about Sharia law because of the harm it causes women. Causes women unbelievable harm. Two, on the other hand, if the local culture community wants to have Sharia law, who are we to say, no, you can't have Sharia law? But my reservation, which is deep about Sharia law, is its implementation, its impact on women. Sir.
Hi, my name is Sam Foley. I'm a political science major here. I guess my question to you was, looking back at the occupation of Iraq, Afghanistan, how we kind of made ourselves the object of hate. We removed a regime, and then we put ourselves in and, you know, made ourselves hated by nations, countries, you know, tribes, everything and such. Do you see that how we're perceived now with drone strikes and countries of no conflict and everything like that, are we perceived more violently now as for this detached type of aggression, or is it still along the same lines, or was the actual physical occupation more detrimental to how our perception is in these countries?
There's a great blog called the Law of War blog, which is a terrific blog, which is the best at accumulating, gathering empirical information about drones, and has taken a long, hard look at the harm done to Pakistani children. Drones, the noise evidently is fearsome when it's lower, right? And what you call the long-term harm, right, has been, I think, largely unaddressed. When you kill somebody, right, you obviously cause consternation to his immediate community. But the drones are different. Let me explain to you why the drones are different. One, because of the scary sense of technology up in the air firing away. Two, seriously, the noise, right? And three, the sense of this all-seeing big brother type thing that sees you from, you know, wherever it is firing away. The studies indicate, and again, one has to be careful here about the word studies, right? Okay. That the long-term possible harm to the young people younger than you, they call it the younger generation of Pakistan, Afghanistan, is going to be significant, and that the repercussions in terms of how the U.S. is perceived is going to be pretty significant. Also, even though, note, they don't see American soldiers, right? But they clearly see the ramifications. Have we thought that one through? I think it's been perceived as, you know, the cost of war. But I'd be very careful with that term, cost of war, because you have to think about it long and hard, long term, strategically, what are the costs of war? And that goes back to what I told you earlier about my belief that in the limited impact, sorry, the need to have limited use of force, in many ways precisely because of what you're talking about.
Hi, my name is Adrian Spiegel. I'm a psychology and peace and conflicts major. I was just wondering in regards to information flow, we were talking about transparency and translucency. Couldn't transparency also lead to solving problems instead of causing more issues for global leaders, such as your situation with that Gaza Strip negotiation? You found out very late that the Palestinians had no intention of following through. Instead of trying to find intelligence and trying to use intelligence, can we just communicate?
Yeah, so first of all, with respect to transparency, the ACLU filed a lawsuit last year or 2 years ago in the U.S. District Court in New York, calling for the Obama administration's drone policy to be transparent, Freedom of Information Act. And I'm on public record of supporting that. There's nothing to hide. There's nothing to hide at all. Everybody, the whole world knows we drone, and there's no reason not to put the criteria out there, and the bad guys know that. We in Israel have total transparency about that. I mean, everybody knows who's in terms of, in Israel, the guys from Hamas know who in Hamas is a legitimate target. Everybody knows this. Okay, I see no harm in transparency. With respect to my story about the Palestinian guy, so look, when you negotiate, there's a certain amount of disingenuousness that goes on. There's a certain bit of, you know, gamesmanship and flair and flamboyancy and show and all that. I get all that. There's also absolutely a need for intelligence information. What you don't want, and here's where I'm going to contradict myself, okay? The worst thing that can happen when you negotiate is that the media is involved. The media kills negotiations. And I'll give you an example. While negotiating the Safe Passage, we were, I think, five people who spent a day together, hours together. And I was with another one-star general and myself, and we were in his car at 11:30 at night. In Israel, we have news every half hour. Every half hour, there's news. Boom, 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 boom. And the lead story, 11:30 o'clock news, is, and I quote, "dramatic progress made in Safe Passage negotiations." We had finished at about 11:10 that night. We had he and I and two Palestinians, or maybe three Palestinians, had sworn ourselves to absolute and total secrecy. Okay. From 11:10 until 11:30, I was with this guy throughout, with one exception. He went to the restroom, and he didn't need my help, and I didn't need his help, and we went to the restroom. Okay. So with the exception of those 20 minutes, we were together throughout. So it was clear the Palestinians leaked that progress had been made. Now, the result was, when they leaked that progress had been made, the next day we met, huge steps were taken back because the Palestinian public realized that progress had been made, concessions were forthcoming, and then the shit hit the ceiling. It was a deliberate leak by somebody. Interjecting the media into this, was that effective? It was terrible. So I always felt, and the media constantly wanted information, boom, boom, boom. I can raise my right hand as if I were in a court of law and say, I've never leaked anything. I know there are people who leak. There are professional leakers. They have their own agenda. I think at the end of the day, it's incredibly, not always. In the context of negotiations, it's extremely harmful. So I think there, in the context of negotiations, intimate negotiations, transparency, I would not recommend that. And I know I'm contradicting myself, but I think not. Sir.
My name is Steve Bannister. I teach economics here. So without being, I guess, too parochial, I don't think you should take this slide out because it's the only time in this presentation you dealt with it. And I think it's probably in total more important than the cyber idea because it really reflects very basic security needs in a lot of respects.
Would you add cyber to it?
I might, but cyber is such a big...
Could write a book on it.
Yeah, and there's so many aspects to it that you have to be somewhat careful. But up there is also possibly one of the hidden reasons for the Iraq conflict, which is oil. You know, I happen to believe a little bit that was... The U.S. makes a lot of decisions, geopolitical decisions, based on resources, especially oil. So that's feasible. And finally, in general, what I miss a little bit is, I guess, more of a sense of history in the sense of a Charles Kindleberger notion of hegemonic stability and, you know, the lack of what do we expect when we don't have that versus what do we know we had when we did have more stability. Right after World War II, the U.S. dominated, was the hegemon. Right.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I appreciate that very much. I found, again, the book I referenced, Gaddis's biography of Keenan, to be have you read it?
I mean, I have not,
fabulous. He addresses a lot of what you talk about. I think you're right. I think that's a great point. Thank you.
Amos. thanks as always. It sounds like there's a long lunch about the who the hell are we on all of this stuff. But looking at it, and Iraq's an easy one that we blew and we missed it badly. What are there some examples where America got it just right, even though we did intervene, even though we essentially said, this is who the hell we are? To give you three examples, then you can tell me. Like the Marshall Plan,
World War II. That's it.
Not the Bush.
We should have retired.
Not the Bush 41.
We should have retired. We should have retired after World War II, and said we got it right. that's one of the points that comes through loud and clear again in the Kenan book, in the Gaddis book about Kenan, the Marshall Plan. That's America at its most majestic. I mean that very seriously. Even MacArthur got it right in Japan. Hard to think that he got it right, but he got it right. And not diminishing the importance of the emperor to the Japanese people. That is just brilliant. The first Gulf War, maybe the entrance, but the Powell Doctrine, you know, God love Colin Powell, but if you're going to go in, you're going to go in. You don't go in order to, I mean, the whole exit strategy thing. So I think you can make a valid point that at the beginning it worked. The end, I think I don't think it was particularly successful. I think World War II, in many ways, is the crowning moment. Vietnam, obviously, is not a crowning moment. I think Korea, one goes back and forth about Korea. Interventions over the course of, you know, we don't call them assassinations, we call regime change, right? I mean, that we have done over the years in the 1950s. To what end? Because as FDR correctly put it, he's a bastard, but he's our bastard. And that was not really a foreign policy. I think World War II is majestic in that sense. I mean, god-awful, but majestic.
Perfect. Please join me in thanking Professor Guerra for this excellent, insightful point.